please help me welcome our speaker for tonight, Jackie Keaton from Harleysville.
People will be driving out. The first time I told my story, I think I had 30 days, and it was in a meeting in Lambertville, New Jersey. That's where I got sober this time in. And I talked about pedigrees and fountains and mansions and private schools and I don't know, all that kind of stuff. And years later, I spoke again in Lambertville at a Sunday night meeting that, you know, I knew everybody really well by this point. And during the meeting, one of my friends, one of the guys in the, you know, one of the guys in the fellowship raised his hand and he said, "Oh, thank God, Jackie, you really have grown. The first time you spoke, he was like, they were all like, I don't know if we can, you know, I don't know if we can ever ask her to speak again." So hopefully, you know, in the, 13 years, I just had 13 years last weekend. I was very anniversary oriented when I was new, as, you know, it's a big deal, like, getting a day is a big deal. Getting a week is unbelievable. Getting a 30-day coin to me was, like, amazing. 6 months, and then a year, and then, you know, 2 years was amazing. And, you know, at 13, I was kind of like, oh, yeah, this anniversary coming up. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways in my life, and there are lessons everywhere I turn. And I had this anniversary, and we didn't make it to a meeting that night for some reason, and then the next night we went to this awesome campground meeting, but we got lost and we were late, so I didn't get to know it was my anniversary. And then, you know, on and on, I was like, never really got to do that, I'm Jackie, and I had 13 years thing. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's really not about the 13 years. If I were to take all of my spiritual growth and condense it, it would probably be more like maybe 3 weeks. There's a lot of space for me. I'm happy for that space too, because really the mistakes that I make are one of my most fortunate assets, as I've found out, you know. So I'm an alcoholic, and I was born in Litchfield, Connecticut. And if you were to write a short story about my family, and I would, were to read it, I would say that's the family I wanted. You know, we had everything that we needed. We had loving parents, parents that stayed together. We were wanted, and we had all kinds of great stuff going on in my family. We had some not so great stuff too, which is kind of worth mentioning because I think it does. Those things, those family of origin things, do shape us, and they are things that we, you know, that I certainly have had to develop coping mechanisms to get through childhood and adolescence and all that with. My parents had two children who very tragically drowned at the same time. A year later, my sister was born. a year later I was born, and then 2 years later my brother was born. So, I see videos of the old black and white home videos of my parents at that time, in between and right after my sister was born. And, my parents were terrible. My father was terrible. It's heartbreaking. And, it wasn't until pretty recently that I started thinking about what that must have been like for my father. Until I really started to get out of the self-centered prison that I'd always been in, everything happened to me. It happened to me. It happened because of me. It happened at me. And that tragedy happening, I think it made holidays have a pall of sadness that nobody really understood and nobody talked about. And I know Christmas and Easter, especially, have always been very difficult for me. I'm always kind of anxious and sad during that time. And I think it might have something to do with the way it was in my family where I was raised. Everything was pretty and pretty and, very traditional. I also am epileptic. I had seizures till I was 12. I had seizures at Girl Scouts, at the beach, at sleepovers, at school, pretty much everywhere. So I was pretty much an actual freak. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody have an epileptic seizure. And I've never really experienced one. You have it, you're pretty much in a blackout. So, but I knew, this was very, actually, totally unique to me. It worked for me in a lot of ways. I was the center of attention. When I was having a seizure, everybody dropped everything. And I used it to my advantage. I remember coming back from Vermont once with the family in the station wagon, and I really wanted to lie down by myself in the back seat, so I faked a seizure, and my brother and sister had to get on the way back. So it wasn't all bad. I also got to go to hospitals. I got to go to Boston to the Children's Hospital. I got to watch Dark Shadows, which we didn't have to do. I got to go to Philadelphia, and I would see friends, these neurological wards. We were all in these wards together. We weren't sick. We were fine. No one ever has a seizure anywhere near a doctor or a hospital. It doesn't happen that way. But I had a lot of fun with it. We had go-kart races. I was very heavily medicated from time to time. Narcotics, phenobarbital, mycelline, until I was 12 years old. And then I was taken off that medication just kind of suddenly in those days. This was like the early 70s. I don't know if people knew about tapering off or anything. I just remember walking in wet rubber for like a couple of days and really not being able to, not knowing what was going on. But the medication was part of the whole deal. Part of the, they did everything, went to a lot of expense and effort to try and get me to the point where I was okay, And two people who had been very, very seriously traumatized by loss. So they did a great job. My mom, bless her, she always let me go do everything like a normal kid, and she must have been, I don't know if it was my child, I would have been going like, you're not going anywhere, blah, blah, blah. So that wasn't really that debilitating. What it did do, I think, and having done two outside help and therapy over the years to figure out what my story is, I think when I was 12, I probably had the emotional maturity of a much younger child, and I was 6 feet tall at the age of 12. And, so I'm a freak having these seizures, and I'm also in the nursery school picture, like, here's my kids and here's me. I used to pray when I was 12. I used to pray, please just let me be a normal girl with long hair that just fits into the crowd. I just want to be lost in the crowd. I do not want to be tall. I do not want to be special. I do not want to be an epileptic. And alcohol, alcohol worked that out for me to a degree. I just wanted to add one more thing about my childhood. Oh, like the culture of my family. We all grow up in an environment that's to a degree composed of that environment. That's our experience. That's what we know. In my family, it was a little confusing. My mother was a politician She was a politician. We did a lot of things with her. We were on stages. We were in a lot of photographs and in the newspaper. She was in the newspaper a lot. She was a very powerful person by career in the little town that we lived in, and she could get things done. So anytime we got in trouble, my mom would just get in the car and go. And like one time, I got detention for a teacher threw a piece of chalk at me, and I whipped it back at him, and it didn't match. So he gave me detention, and then he forgot. And so there I was after school, like I was sitting at the desk, and he forgot. He didn't show up. And when she found out about that, she was furious because I was having seizures, you know. And she came down and she told him if he ever so much as wiggled his little toe again, she would have him banned from 3 states from teaching and his life would be over. And everybody found out about this, and I was mortified. But she really had my back. You know, she was a type of. But the messages, I don't know what all they said because I have a brother and a sister and we all ended up very different people. But the sound bite I carried with me for life was, you're better than that. You know, you're better than that. I don't know what that means. I don't know what the that is. It sometimes means people, sometimes it means behavior. And the other thing was, what the hell is the matter with you? So I'm better than that. What the hell is the matter with me? So that was kind of my, you know, that was my what I had to fall back on to figure things out. And I didn't know. So the first time I got drunk was when I was 12. My friend Missy had her prophet stuff, and her parents had this wine cellar, and they had champagne, and I got a bottle of champagne, and I drank the whole bottle out of a plastic tumbler, and I was like, oh, it's great, it's just like lemonade, you can like just drink it right down, and I got completely polluted. I threw up all over their guest bathroom, which was bad. We weren't allowed in the front of their house, and my parents had to come and pick me up, and my friend Missy, she was like, Jackie's sick, I don't know what's wrong with her, but she's not feeling well. My parents, you know, my mom, I guess, got there, and she was right down the street, and she was like, you're drunk! And I was like, oh! So she took me home, and I think I was sick for a day, hungover, and they had a big date that night they couldn't go to, so I got in a little bit of trouble for that, but drinking was part of the culture of our family. My parents were big entertainers, they had cocktail parties. We had this house that was built for parties. It had a wall that slid, so the guests would go down. Downstairs there was a bar, it was a real bar. It was really a lovely place to grow up. And then this panel would slide, and the dining room would be all set, and it was our job to pass out the cocktails. And of course, we ate all the cherries and the onions and drank all the rest of the whiskey sours. So I had some drinking experience as a little kid. And we were allowed to sip this and that and taste, you know, have a little wine, you know, there's a lot of social training going on. But I got drunk, and I just thought it was great. I mean, I know I was kind of in trouble, but I definitely thought, like, that was easy. Life is a total mind-bending mystery to me, but that was easy. So I went along. I decided, probably at the age of 13, that I wanted nothing more to do with my family. And I must have been completely impossible to deal with because I really couldn't stand any of them. I didn't want to do things with them. I didn't want to sit at the dinner table with them. I really could not stand them. I really cut them off. I didn't talk to them for years. I went to a small school in New England in Connecticut, and that's where I learned to smoke pot. And, you know, my parents had to invest money in the school for me. And I didn't want to go. I wanted to go to the high school with everybody else. I didn't want to go, but once I got there, after a few weeks, I found found out that this is where all the rich kids are who party, who have really good drugs. So I learned how to smoke pot every day there. I also learned how to make jewelry, which has ended up being something I still do today. I went from there to college and really just partied. I got through. I got a good grade point average. I went to a pretty easy college, big rah-rah school. It was a lot of fun. I thought, you know, with this is the time of my life. This is the most fun anyone could ever have, and it really was. You know, living in a dorm, you have dining hall, and all you can do is walk to class. Now looking back, I realized that a lot of that time I spent going, what am I supposed to be doing? I was a metal sinking major. I was an art major. I just was lost. I was like, what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. You know. So I went to another school after that where I met my first husband, and he was the chair of my department in that school. He was a technical school for sculptors, and he had a bottle of whiskey in his desk drawer, and you could go in and have a nip of this whiskey any time of the day. And where we worked, there were these big vents, these fluidized vents, and these big vents, so we could smoke pot all throughout the day. So I thought he was great, you know, and he was, I really was very much in love with him when I met him, and his, you know, the way he partied. So we got married. I went to, eventually went to graduate school in New York City. I went to graduate school because I was working at an Ivy League school, and I could see that all the people with the interesting jobs had higher degrees. So I figured, well, I better get one. So I went to this ball buster of a school in New York City, and it was hard. It was really hard. I had to study. I had to really go everywhere with the dictionary. I had really not learned a whole lot to that point. And I was very completely and thoroughly humiliated by a teacher there. It was something that, like, something broke inside me when this happened. The beginning of my third year, and I stood up to this teacher, and I went to the administration, and they were all New Yorkers. They were all New York, successful New York artists. And, the, you know, these people are not, they're not very sympathetic. And part of this school, part of this program, was this constant weeding out of students. You were reviewed every 6 months. And I had been to this other technical school, and I knew all these successful artists, people who had recommended me, and that was a big part of why I got into this school. It's very hard to get into. At the same time, though, like, I had all these connections, you know, I had this husband, I had the opportunity to go in limos to parties in New York where Liza Minnelli was there, and these like artists that were all over the New York Times, and I would be in these parties, and I was drinking, definitely, before, during, and after, but I was never able to be on. I was just not on. I was off. I was lost. I had such intense anxiety and what do you call it? I thought everybody was watching me all the time and saying, and I thought this as a little kid, too. I remember going to a movie theater when I was maybe in 8th or 9th grade. My friends were already in there, and it was dark. And I'm walking up and down the aisles, and I'm convinced that everybody in the movie theater is looking at me going, what a jerk. She's an idiot. Get out of here. So, self-centered, that's the word for it. I was acutely tuned in to every single nuance. That's how sensitive I was. I would read everybody and everything like, they figured it out. I'm a loser. You know, they figured it out. I'm a dork. I'm a freak. You know, like, I really want to go. I really want this. I want to be an artist. I want to be famous. I want to be cool. I really want to be cool. And drinking really wasn't helping me so much with that. I was incredibly insecure. And I think that had a lot to do with my, you know, my delayed maturing because of this medication I was on. So I drank, I snorted, I drank. I finally had this experience where this teacher just completely humiliated me, and I went out, and I guess I had decided I was just going to drink myself to death. And this is where I'll tell a little bit of, like, I'll tell you a story or two about what my drinking was like at this point. A lot of it was fun through college, Grateful Dead concerts, like, feeling really good, you know. All that kind of stuff. But this is dangerous. This is New York City. I had really no money. I would go across the street from, I live on 21st and 22nd Street. I'd go over to this Irish bar after class. And there was this guy, his name was Kevin. He was a UPS man. And he was my drinking buddy. And I'm married. My husband lives in Princeton. I'm married by now. And Kevin and I we would meet up, and I would have maybe $5 in my pocket, and I would already have half in the bag, because drinking in New York is expensive. And he and I would go all over New York City. He always had a $100 bill, and I would think about that, like, us men, New York City, probably, you know, like, they're not at the top of the income ladder. And this poor guy, every time I saw him, he had a $100 bill, I'd say, let's go. So we'd go down to Alphabet City, and I would ditch him in some CB After Hours club. And I would go in, and I'd walk right into the men's bathroom where the Haitian criminal guys were, and I'd be like, okay, what are we doing? And whatever they were snorting on the back of the toilet, I would snort. And then I don't remember the ending of many of those nights. I don't know how I got home. I know things started to happen. I started, like, one time I got home, and I had no shoes and socks on. And this is New York City in the winter. I do not know to this day what happened to my shoes and socks. You know, the rest of my clothes were in place. I had room, you know, as far as I know, how to remove them. I also woke up one morning, and I was all achy, and I looked in the mirror, and I had this purple stripe across the back of my leg. And I was like, what the heck is on me? And I realized it was a bruise. And it's like somebody took an I-beam and cracked me with it, like a baseball. I have no idea how I got that, what happened. I was all beat up. I have absolutely no memory. I really would like to know. It's weird. You know, but I was going, this, you know, this is not cool. And finally, my sister, I was sort of freeloading on my sister at her apartment at the time. She said, you know, this has got to stop. You've got to go. You've got to knock it off. Every day I think you're going to be dead. And I was like, you know. So I got sober. I went to the Mustard Seed in New York City. And then I found this cool meeting at St. James Place where people threw chairs and there were like all kinds of crazy people there. And, you know, I went to a few meetings, didn't get a sponsor, didn't get, you know, didn't really look at the steps. I graduated, went home to Princeton and got pregnant right away. And that was, you know, I was extremely happy. Always knew I wanted to be a mom. So I didn't drink or use while I was pregnant. Didn't drink or use for the first year after I had my first child. Then I picked up a beer. So I did this, maybe it was school. You know, well, maybe it was school. Okay, so all the beer. But at the end of 3 months, I was blackout drunk, driving around, really in Princeton at the time. Driving, going to, like, you know, I don't know, the Applebee's or whatever, whoever had a bar, like a safe place where I wasn't going to be kidnapped or anything, and getting hammered and driving home, and I would wake up and sneak out when everybody was asleep, and I would get hammered and come home. So I got really, really, really drunk one night. We would take two cars because Mom needed a break. We'd take two cars to a party. We had a lot of drink. We had all those artist friends still. And so we would take two cars, and my husband would have the baby because I needed a break. I needed time with mom. And I would go out, and I would get totally sloppy, hammered, drunk, blackouts, everything. I'd make it home at some point in the night. And this one night, I went over to someone's house after the party, and we drank mezcal, and we listened to reggae, and then we drank tequila, and then we drank wine and beer, and that's what my drinking was like. It was like, keep drinking until something stops you. Passing out, running out, or getting dragged home by my husband. So, you know, it's 5 in the morning, and I have this massage the next day. I have to get home so I can have this massage. Somebody was coming to my house to give me a massage. So I got in the car, and trying to drive home. I'm like, I'm just too drunk to drive. I don't care about being pulled over. I drove drunk all the time. It was, like, not a problem. Driving hungover, I believe, was more dangerous than driving drunk. Sometimes that's true. I had to wait, sit on the steps and wait, you know, like, all drunk, tired. It was really irritating. I had to wait until I stopped seeing dull, and I'd go sit in the car, and I'd be like, no, not yet, and I'd go back and sit on the steps. No, not yet. But finally, you know, I don't know what, it was dawn, I drove home, and I got this massage, and I was like, I gotta stop doing this. Going on the wagon. So I go on the wagon, and 2 weeks. I think I made it 2 weeks, and I just didn't feel good. I was barking at everybody. I was cranky. I felt nauseous. One time that I was pregnant again, and I was like, oh, thank God, because I was, and really, I'm very glad that somehow the choice was taken out of my hands at the time when I was carrying my two children, because I didn't do it, and I can so see myself doing it, you know. I somehow got through those pregnancies, plus you don't really drink coffee or smoking or drinking anything when you're pregnant, you know, when I was pregnant. So I had my second child, and same thing, about 6 months later, I'm like, well, maybe it was just having one child, maybe not have two. You know, I'll have a beer, what can it do? So I have a beer, and same exact thing, maybe now it's a month later, I'm out. And this, now we're living in Lambertville, and I'm very involved. Well, at that time I wasn't, but I kept drinking until my younger daughter was 5. And it was at this time when I started waking up every morning going, I can't do this anymore. So I did that for years, literally. I woke up every morning going, oh, shit, this is my life. And for at least five years. At one point, I go into the cartwheel at 2 in the morning by myself, which is a gay bar in New Hope. Waking up, getting in my mini scoop, you know, sneaking out and rolling the car down the driveway and off the cartwheel I go. And I'm in there and I'm dancing. I like the cartwheel because it's all gay guys. And, you know, I want to make sure everybody, my parents, everybody knows I am not promiscuous. Okay? I am not promiscuous. That is not my problem. I just like to party and there's no one left to party with. So I go to a gay bar, and then I have all the faces covered. Gay guys, you know, I did have one couple of gay guys come over and ask me to carry their child for them. And I was very sure. You have nice cheekbones. And I was like, oh, thank you. What is wrong with you? I'm a mother of two alone, drunk in a gay bar at 2 in the morning. You want me to carry your child? You need to have a better criteria. No. I'm not going to be pregnant for another year. Holy shit, no way. So, they offered me $50,000 too, but I said no. So, I'm in the cartwheel, and I see this guy who I'm involved with, the school board, the local school board. I was an introduction. I had a master's degree. I was not some hasty generational member of this community in Lambertville. I was going to single-handedly turn the school system around with the help of all the other newcomer intellectuals and people, you know, college. We went college for our children in the school system. It was not good enough. So by day, I'm this probably pretty obnoxious, overbearing, arrogant housewife. You know, the housewife. By night, I'm like this. Yeah, let's go to a gay bar and dance. I see this guy there, and I'm like, whoa, the girls are getting a little too close here. Someone's going to figure it out. And I just remember that moment because I remember thinking, like, I am not even really one person. I'm like maybe 4 or 5 people. I'm this Jackie for the mothers who have the nice cars, and I'm this Jackie for the mothers who don't have such nice cars. And I'm this Jackie for the children who are like a very small group of children who are somehow excel above mine, because I believed my children were like perfect, and if anyone went anywhere near them, you know, it's not like my mom. When my children were born, I seriously thought other mothers were going to drop their babies on the sidewalk to run over and look at my children. I really thought this was happening. So I was really So what really got me sober was my little daughter, Alden, was 5 years old, and she was sitting in the box at the, you know, peninsula thing in our kitchen, and she said, Mommy, would you love me if I was an angel with wings? And I said, what? You know, I'm hungover. And at this point, my drinking, like, there are too many, I'm sneaking out, going out alone, pretty regularly. There's no one else who wants to drink the way I do. And even the ones who do, I drink more, you know, I'm embarrassed by my behavior, so I don't really want to drink with people I know anymore. So most of my drinking is done in the kitchen at 5 o'clock. Smoking pot every morning, which I hated. I hated doing that. I did it for years. I hated it, but I still did it. Every day. First thing, I hit a pot, and then I'd be like, I'm having a juice glass, a pretty big juice glass, and reading to my girls, which one I have an alarm, I'm too tired to finish the story tonight. So my daughter, my older daughter, learned to read at the age of 4. You know, she finished the story for her little sister. And I'm starting to wake up in the middle of the night with panic attacks, anxiety attacks. I didn't know what they were, but my heart would start pounding, I would be wide awake, and I would be in a state of huge anxiety. I was a college professor at the time. I worked two days back-to-back. I went to Philadelphia and stayed over and taught like 3 classes in 2 days. And it was happening, it was affecting my ability to work because I wasn't getting any sleep. I was, you know, getting drunk, passing out, waking up at 2 in the morning, being up till 4:30. I tried Tylenol PM. That made me feel worse. I tried exercise. I tried yoga. I tried therapy. I do think I got a lot, I got a lot of important information about myself out of therapy, and I don't need to poo-poo that at all. People really helped me. And yoga's not bad either, but it didn't resolve the problem. But I was trying all these different things, and my daughter, I called my friend Judith, who's a therapist, and I said, my daughter said this, and she said, get that child to the therapist right now. So she gave me a name, and I took her to the therapist, and this woman probably took one look at me and went like, okay, because I used to get stoned before I took her. Not stoned like 9 joints, but just making this one hit a pot. And then, there I am, like, oh, I'm sitting in the office with the noise machine on while my little 5-year-old was in there. And finally, this woman came out to me and she said, I'd like to talk to you for a few minutes if you come in. And I said, sure. And she sat me down and she said, are you all right? Like we say to each other, are you all right? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, no, really, are you all right? And I was like, yeah. And she said, you're a good person. And I said, I remember thinking like, fuck you, I don't know. Get out of my face, lady. I'm a bad person, I'm cool. And she said, you might have some issues. I think your daughter has some issues with depression at 5 years old. And there is a history of serotonin uptake issues that have been passed down through generations. And I was like, oh, really? And she said, you should go see this friend of mine. She's a psychiatrist. Get an evaluation. You never know. And I was kind of like, all right. I guess I can do that. So we had great insurance, but I didn't want the government to know, that I had depression. I didn't want anyone to know I had mental illness. So I decided, well, I'm going to pay for it out of pocket. So I go, it's $300. I'm like, Jesus Christ, $300. If it's $300, then I'm telling the truth. That was the first time I ever told anyone the truth. And it was 300 questions, $1 a question. How do you empty the dishwasher? How much do you drink? How do you drive? How much pot do you smoke? And I said, okay, forget it. I'm just answering, honestly. And meantime, I had been on the board of this mental health agency in Princeton, a decade before when I lived there. It was a mental health service agency, nonprofit agency. And I'd get stoned and have a couple cocktails before I went to their board meetings. I saw nothing wrong with that. And I'm sitting there going, the head nurse came in to give a presentation and she said, any questions? And I'm like, she said, yes. And I said, how do you know when someone comes to you if they really need help? And she goes, I don't understand the question. And I said, well, how do you know they really need help and they're not just, lonely or something? And she goes, people don't usually ask for help unless they need it. Like, we assume if somebody is asking for help, for you know, a drug or alcohol problem, that they're at the point where they need the help. And I was like, oh, okay. So 10 years later, I'm in the psychiatrist's office, and she says, well, you know, the results come back. And I'm back, and she says, well, you have this thing called dysthymia, which is a low-grade depression. And I did. I drove around my whole life with a cinder block on my chest. I couldn't breathe. It was physical. It's like my throat was closing all the time. And I'd be racking my brain. What is wrong with me? Why am I so upset? And the drinking helped with that. 5 o'clock, I had my drink. I drank that drink. I was cool. I was happy. I was successful. I was young. I was fabulous. And that 5 minutes, when the alcohol hits my brain and it does whatever it does, you know, the blood vessels open up and it gets into my brain, that was like what I lived for, that feeling. And it was worth sacrificing every night and every day for. And I woke up, I figured it out once, over 400 times in a row, saying, I've got to stop doing this. 400 days in a row, that's a lot. So that speaks to, you know, our book talks about all of these things. You know, no amount of self-knowledge or logical thinking was going to help me. I was beyond help, you know. So I get this evaluation, and she says, well, there's a medication that can help you, but you really can't drink alcohol on it. Would that be a problem? And I'm like, no. Okay, well, you know, if it's a problem, there's always AA. And I'm like, oh, AA, I know all about AA. I've been to AA. I'm like, no, it's no problem. And I go home and I'm like,
oh, God, I got to go to AA.
So I walk in, I see the guy. First person I see is a friend of ours whose daughter had babysat for me, who I had picked up completely wasted. Got stuck in the mud, and I went to turn around, got stuck in a field. And he had to come out and get me out, and we missed the dinner, and everything was a big disaster. And so I see him, and I ultimately go, oh, shit. Oh, no. Paul's going to know I was wasted that time. This guy, Paul, you know, I had his 18-year-old daughter in the car. That was picking her up. That's how wasted I was. Forget driving her home. I don't even remember that. But I'm like, oh, he's like, everybody's going to know. You know how we all are. Everybody's going to know. My secret will be out. And he looked at me and smiled, and he pointed to me, and he was like, you know, come sit next to me. And a couple of years later, I made an amend to him for that. And I said, you know, Pat, I drove with your daughter, Laurel, completely wasted, as I did with my own children all the time. But I'll tell you, if anybody else, if I found out they had driven with my children in their car, I would have their head. I would kill them. So there were a lot of contradiction, no integrity. I had no integral belief or behavior throughout all these different decision making things in life. So he said, "What do you think that's bad? When she was a baby, I took her to North Philly or South Philly or wherever you get drugs, and I left her in her car seat with the door open while I went and cop drugs, and I forgot she was there, and I came back 2 hours later and thank God she was still there." And I was like, "What?" So I start going to AA, and I hear this guy speak, and he's up there and he's saying, my feeling's this, and I feel this way, and I feel that way. I'm like, what is wrong with these people? What is wrong with these men? This is just weird. It was shocking to me. I was absolutely enamored in love with the fact that you could speak without being interrupted, because I had not had that experience. I loved that. And I set about really trying to impress everybody in AA, like I talked about before. First time I made coffee, you know, took a service commitment, I brought the water from home. I did. I brought the coffee ground. Like, I'm going to blow. I brought whole milk, my special whole milk. That was really good. And I made cookies. I made a lot of cookies. But I was going to change. You know, they were all going to be like, yeah. Coffee, it's like no coffee we've ever had. No one knows. But I came, I did a 12 and 90, my first 90 days. I don't recommend that. Not because I wanted to, but my husband did not want me to get sober. He didn't want me to be a drunk either. But my parents said, you're not an alcoholic. You know, you really don't have to be a vegetarian, you know. You don't have to be an alcoholic, for God's sake. All my friends said, can't you just cut back? People, I was very angry, both at everybody in the program and at everybody outside of the program, because I sat there feeling like, stop me. So, you know, I thought everybody was saying, stop making such a big deal about yourself. You're not an alcoholic. Just knock it off. Just shut up. And, you know. So, in the area where I got sober, it was really tough to find somebody to work with. Now, it may have been because I had this incredibly intimate relationship with my ego. It was me and my ego my whole life. We were like best friends. I was its best friend, and it told me what to do, and I did what it told me. And, you know, I learned to have a healthier relationship with that person, that ego. Now I have boundaries, but in those days I didn't. So it was very hard for me to take direction. And also in the area, and this kind of brings me back around to Feet First and why it's so special to me, there was not a lot of work coming out of the Big Book. We had the steps on the wall. We had step meetings. We had, you know, the 12 and 12 in the Big Book. But I really didn't know what the heck I was supposed to be doing. You know, I heard what I heard, and I managed not to drink, and I've been through some really painful things and not had to pick up a drink. But I got sponsors, and we sat in the car and talked, and I wrote, you know, about the first step, and I stayed on the first step for a year, which is what I was told to do. I'm only one person. And I changed sponsors. And I kept not drinking and going to meetings. And that's the way it was there. And I'm sure that there were people there who had the solution, but I couldn't find them. And I honestly say that because I wanted more. I was still pretty, you know, pretty self-centered, pretty paralyzed by self-centered and righteous. What I thought was right behavior was really pretty much righteous. And competitive and all of those other things. So, I guess I was about 6 years sober. I was at Stockton, and I'm sitting there, and this guy had kind of breathed into the town with his entourage, and his name was Greg. And he stood up and he told his story, and he said, essentially, you're not getting, you know, we're not getting sober for us. We're getting sober for the next person who comes in behind us. And I went, oh, you know, oh, okay. Like, that's really cool. Because I don't do anything for me. I only do everything so I can look good. I do everything for the stamp of approval. I don't do anything, like, I really don't matter. I could be dead, no one would care. I really don't matter. But when he said that, I went, oh. And he really polarized the community. And there were about four of us on his side, and everybody else was on the other side. And we used to call the people in this area the, it's getting my mind now, God Squad. And this, I think, Pete, first it was, I'm a little mixed up there, because I think this was right when he came up here and started. You know, he and other people got together, and I think it was at that time this meeting started. I don't know who technically started the meeting, but I started coming up here about 4 years ago to this meeting, and coming to this meeting and hearing people talk about the solution as a thing, as a course of study, as a way of life, I started to go, oh my God, like there is something here. And I've been looking for this, but I really honestly believe I couldn't find it. I had a wonderful sponsor, and she's still kind of a sponsor to me today. Her name is Susan S. And she carried me through divorce and all kinds of, you know, those things in life that happened. And she's a lovely person, and she understood the program, but she did work out of the Big Book. And, you know, nobody where I grew up in NA did, really. They didn't like the Big Book. The Big Book was for men. The Big Book was old. And, you know, we would kind of try to read the Big Book, but we'd all fall asleep. You know, you read the Big Book at night when you can't sleep. probably. And that's what it was to me. And I was like, okay, whatever, you know, it's not for me. But as I came up here, as I listened to the message here in this group, I started going, wow, you know, I have work to do. I'm whatever, 8 years sober, 9 years sober. I have all the work still to do. So I found a sponsor up here, and I went through the steps with her about halfway through the steps, and I had this new, and it was Sandy, I don't know who she is. But she said one thing to me that I remember getting, and after all these years of reading all this stuff and talking and all that, she said to me, you know, you have a new job. Your new job is you're going to help God's kids. And she said, if you do this job even a little bit right, you're going to get your toes into a kingdom that is going to blow your mind. And I went, whoa. Because I had been to graduate school, and I knew all about nihilism, which means the universe is rushing nowhere, and every thought and tradition is meaningless. And people who believe in God are stupid. They're brainwashed. You know, this was my spiritual axiom, nihilism. That's what the Nazis used. It's what the communists used. It's not, you know, like I thought it was proven. I thought that was the proof. So, you know, I had to start to make my mind open up to this idea, and it was very difficult. I had been told by a sponsor back when I was in the New Hope area, you know, I had to meet God somewhere, because I really couldn't. I could not. I'm not stupid. I was not willing. I didn't even know what willingness was. I could not know what I didn't know, and I still didn't know. And she said, okay, well, every time you find a penny, pick it up, put it in your pocket, say, this is God. And I was like, no, that won't really work for me, because I'm a Connecticut Yankee, and I already pick up all the money I ever find. So that's not special. Well, I'll find something else. So I've never been able to find a four-leaf clover. And I know whoever's heard my story has heard this before, but I love it. She said, well, look for four-leaf clovers. Then, you know, you can do that. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do that. Because I knew I was not going to find one. I've been looking my whole life. I never was able to find one. So off I go, and I'm walking up this hill. I like to climb steep hills for exercise. And I'm like, I'm looking down, I see this four-leaf clover, and I'm like, oh, shit. Pick it. Go back the next day. I'm looking in the grass, see, find two of them. Okay. I'm like, whoa, God is here. This is creepy. So I go back every day, and I start finding 20 a day, 10 a day, 8 a day, big four-leaf clovers, little four-leaf clovers. Everywhere I go, I find them. I can, you know, we're on our way to Connecticut this weekend. I got out the red stop. I found two in the grass right there. So the message that I got was, God is there, but you have to meet him somewhere. He, him, them, it. You know, to me, it has become out of convenience, a he. And I heard a gentleman speak up in the Poconos a couple of weeks ago, and he said, I have a higher power, and his name is Sam. It's an acronym for Charade Me. And I just said, that is for me, because I'm, you know, working on this relationship, this moment-to-moment relationship. And that, you know, it's just a few weeks old, but already it's helped me, you know, like I'm willing today. I'm not stuck in that octagonal mirror box anymore. You know, TJ Maxx, you know, the triple mirror, and then the mirrors in the dressing room. That's what it was like for me. I was in the sock. Everywhere I looked was me. And I didn't know this. You know, I could not come out of that prison of self. I would love to have been able to do that. I wanted to be a good person, but I couldn't. I couldn't. And, you know, what this program does for me, and it's really only in sitting down one-on-one with another lady who is at a point where she's given up where I was, and I'm able to try, even though it defies explanation, and I have to really work on myself not to be embarrassed about my deep and serious faith these days, because I was such a flip, you know, punk about and disrespectful about religion my whole life. But it's in that that I'm lifted out of that. It's like a 180. I'm lifted out of that octagonal mirrored prison. And I'm able to look out on the world through, I imagine this to be almost like a rose window in a church. I can look out on people, on situations. I can see my own thoughts over there in that little box going, wow. And I'm like, me, God.
Me,
God. And I have that now. And it's that's recovery. And it's been a long, slow road, and it ain't over yet, you know? I just wanted to close by reading something from Bill's story. I'm totally in love with Bill's story right now. I'm reading it all the time. Anyway, the last two paragraphs of Bill's story, but there is, however, a vast amount of fun about it. I was talking about how disgusting we are, you know, how drunk alcoholics are disgusting creatures, and we don't need to tell us that. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all, about AA. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath, there is a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need to look no farther than most of us feel we need to look no further for utopia. We have it right. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. And the last thing I want to say is how much I adore saying the Lord's Prayer at the end of every meeting. Holding hands, saying the Lord's Prayer. I absolutely adore that. And it's always such a privilege to be able to do that with all of you. Thanks for being here.